Computer.
This meeting is being recorded.
Okay. So, welcome to this meeting hosted by Consistent Democrats. This is on the current world situation, the genocide, etc., and the situation in Ukraine. That there's been some dramatic changes in the last few weeks. But I shall probably speak for about half an hour, if that's okay. And at the end of that presentation, we'll have discussion, and Paul will be chairing. We actually have made a decision to have Paul chair the meeting, not me, because I'm probably not the best chair in the world, and Paul is very good at this sort of thing. And I think we need to have a proper chairing at these meetings. So I will start, if that's okay. Yes. So this is on the present. This is a presentation on the current situation. Let me turn this thing to silent. That's it. Okay. So the ceasefire agreed by Israel and touted by Trump in January as his work was blown away pretty openly, actually, on the 17th of March by Israel with Trump's full support. And the mass terror bombings resumed with the bloodiest day of the genocide so far, actually, 400 people butchered in one night, many burned alive in their tents. And since then, this has carried on every bloody day, you know. And that was after a fortnight of Gaza being deprived of food, water and fuel. Israel making no bones about openly embarking on mass starvation, freezing and dehydration of Palestinians. So I think the lesson for Russia, and we'll come on to that later, is quite clear that Trump's word is actually worthless. And the ceasefire he touted never got beyond the first phase of exchanges of batches of 3 to 6 Israeli hostages for hundreds of Palestinians from Israel's torture and rape camps, which is a fair description of what they are, actually. Total blockade of food, water, with the open support of Trump, made a sick joke of any second phase of the ceasefire. Trump gave the green light for this latest genocide and hinted that he intends to do the same and give the green light to doing it in the West Bank as well. And Israeli repression has certainly mushroomed in the West Bank in the last period, in the last several months, actually. And the stooge Palestinian Authority has taken it in turns with the Israelis to particularly attack Jenin, among other places, which is probably the most strategically important of the Palestinian centres, refugee camps in the West Bank. The hospitals and infrastructure are now under similar attacks in the West Bank as they have been for the last 16, 17, 18 months in Gaza. The Palestinians, though, are again receiving the solidarity, physical solidarity, of Yemen. The Amanullah, the Houthi leaders, so-called, have had the courage to stand up for the Palestinians in military action against Israel, against its shipping, and that of its sponsors and quartermasters in the US and elsewhere. And this is not some elite terrorist movement, as the imperialists would have it. It's got the support of millions of Yemenis who regularly turn out in the streets, in those millions, to demonstrate their solidarity with the Palestinian people faced with genocide. And now that Trump, who's an open genocidaire, I suppose that's probably a good way to call him, an open genocidaire on the Palestinian question. Now he's in the White House. The whole game of seeking to pressure the US, to pressure Israel, which persisted when Joe Biden, called Genocide Joe, was in the White House, has come to an end. Because Trump is just openly supportive of genocide, doesn't make any bones about it. You know, he says that Israel... Sorry, the US would buy Gaza and forcibly deport the Palestinian population that lives there somewhere else so they can have a Riviera for the wealthy. That's his his solution involves mass deportation. And if they don't move, they kill them. You know, that's what he's more or less openly said. This plan was mooted by Trump's Jewish Zionist son-in-law, Kushner, last year. And Trump's real aim in saying this is to steal, either for the United States or for Israel, or both, the oil and gas reserves that have been found off the Gaza coast in the past decade or so. And they're openly saying it. They're openly saying that genocide is good, basically, not even bothering to deny it. And Trump's made it clear that he considers that Palestinians are subhuman. He even uses the Palestinian as a racial epithet, akin to those used for black people, like nigger, you know. He calls people effectively nigger lovers. That's what he means when he accused one of his Democratic opponents of being a Palestinian for refusing to endorse his openly genocidal program. Of course he supports it, but doesn't prepare to openly support it. That's different, you know. Trump's rise to power was funded by Netanyahu's party, Likud, to the tune of $100 million through Miriam Adelson, who is one of the most who's the widow of Sheldon Adelson. And the Adelsons are one of the most influential oligarchical dynasties of dual citizen US Israelis. With Trump in office, both Israel and the US will therefore have to be defeated militarily in some way by the masses or a superior military force to have a hope of stopping the genocide. There's no illusions about that anymore, I think. And it's hardly surprising that Trump's attitude to the Yemeni masses is genocidal also. And this was shown by the US bombing of the Oncology and Cancer Treatment Center in Sana'a in Yemen on the 27th of March, 3 days ago. And that's exactly what the IDF have been doing in Gaza and now the West Bank for the last 16, 17, 18 months. They can't even lie. The Americans can't even lie that this facility is somehow occupied by terrorists. I mean, that's the pathetic lie that they use in the West Bank. But they haven't even got that fig leaf, you know. They just bombed it because they want to stop Yemenis from accessing medicine, you know. However, their bombings of Yemen have had zero effect on the military capacity of the Amalullah movement to hit Israel or to blockade shipping in the Red Sea. Despite the American airstrikes, Yemen has a vast array of hidden missile sites buried deep underground that the United States has not got the means, even with their supposed bunker buster bombs, to find and destroy. And it also has hypersonic missile technology, which it gained from Iran, and which obviously has its origins in Russia, which is interesting, of course. Serious military analysts note that the US does not remotely have the capacity to defeat Amanullah with aerial bombardment. And given the size of the country, the roughness of the terrain, and the armed capacity of Amanullah, it would take hundreds of thousands of US troops, maybe even a million, to subdue Yemen. And they do not remotely have such troops at their disposal. The United States has now got less than 500,000 troops available for such an endeavour, and as well as a population that's wary of such wars, particularly since Iraq, Afghanistan, their foray into Lebanon in 1983, which cost them a huge death toll from one bomb, 241 US Marines in October 1983, not to mention the Vietnam War, of course. You know, as well as the Amanullah movement confronting Zionism, in the background, there's actually Hezbollah in Lebanon. There are Iraqi radicals such as Kataib Hezbollah in Iraq. And, of course, there's Iran as well, you know. And all those are targets of Zionism and its enforcers. But, you know, in terms of a potential American war against Iran, The fact is that Iran is four times the size of Iraq, and it has a much larger population, which would be very difficult to subdue. It's much more heavily armed than Iraq was at the time of the invasion in 2003. And it's got similar military technique to Yemen, but in far greater quantity. And that puts US and Israeli threats against Iran in perspective. It also has a quasi-military alliance that's not quite explicit as to its limits, but it's there, an alliance with Russia, you know, which also should give the Americans pause, you know. So all of these forces of the Axis of Resistance are steadfast in their defiance of Zionism and imperialism, though they suffered a serious blow, at least in the short term, with the overthrow of Assad in Syria at the end of 2024. And Syria is now under the rule of Western-backed Al-Qaeda, ISIS, jihadist genocidaires, actually, themselves, now known as HTS, which is Hayat al-Tahrir al-Sham, which means Organization for the Liberation of the Levant, I believe. That's what it means. But it's basically Al-Qaeda ISIS under another name. Now, the collapse of the Assad regime in December means that the route of communication between Iran and its allies in Lebanon has now been cut, or at least it seems to have been cut, and replaced by a genocidal regime of Sunni sectarian killers. And as part of its mission, the HTS has launched a massive slaughter of tens of thousands from Syria's Alawite Shia population and its Christian population, as well as killing Sunnis who refuse to cooperate with the slaughter that they've been carrying out. And some sources reckon that up to 30,000 have been killed in Syria in the last few weeks by these jihadists, these genocidaires. So, I mean, what can you say about all this? That there are reactionary social forces in West Asia and the Middle East are shaken, obviously, by what's been going on, but they're digging in very hard, you know. And it will take some very deep-going political and social struggles, mobilising the masses against these forces independently to really transform this situation. And what's needed is the emergence of the emergence of a new communist leadership amongst the Arab and Muslim masses is necessary, and also the creation of an anti-imperialist united front of all those who are in conflict with the Zionists, with the US and their agents. I mean, for Trump, expelling the Gaza population and the US doing so are pretty much the same thing. You know, whether Israel does it or whether the US does it, it's the same for Trump. It's all the same, but it's piracy and it's a motive for genocide. Trump's pretty open about his intentions to steal the natural resources of territories he covets. You know, during his first term, he boasted openly that the US troops in Syria, which were originally sent in by Barack Obama, supposedly to fight ISIS, they're really there to steal Syria's oil for the United States. And Trump openly said that. And his policies in Ukraine have a similar motive, like his demand that Ukraine signs over ownership of $500 billion worth of rare earth metals as reparation for the aid that it was given by Biden in the last few years. You know, his motive is just naked theft, whatever he touches. You know, apparently much of this resource is actually located in the Donbass, though, which is part of Russia now. So that's a bit of a problem for him, you know. Now, we saw the explosion of the Ukraine issue, particularly with Zelensky's confrontation with Trump and his vice president, Vance, on the 28th of February in the Oval Office. And that's actually come close to tearing NATO apart. I mean, NATO has teetered on the brink of collapse over the last few weeks as Trump's changed priorities have sent the West European bourgeoisie, particularly the British and the French, into paroxysms of rage and warmongering. Basically because Trump and Zelensky came up with a variant of the previous Minsk agreement deceptions, that may well be what is behind what Trump is proposing, or it appears to be. And this was hardly hidden, really, because the original plan was that if there was a truce commenced, the US would restore military and economic aid to Ukraine that Trump had actually suspended after that blazing row in the Oval Office. But the military situation militates against that, because Russia has virtually driven Ukraine out of its diversionary incursion into Kursk, which is in undisputedly Russian territory, and it's been rapidly advancing in the Donbass, and it still is. Yeah, and Putin, for tactical reasons, appears to have made a perfunctory show of welcoming in principle the idea of a ceasefire, but made it clear that Russia would expect such a pause to mean a route to a permanent solution, not a revamped Minsk. And for Russia, such a solution would mean the recognition of Crimea as Russian, and likewise recognition of the four provinces that have already voted in referenda to join Russia, i.e. Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson and Zaporozhye, and likely similar proper referenda of the populations in Kharkov and Odessa. And it would actually mean the eviction of power of the Nazified elements, the acceptance of Ukrainian neutrality and non-NATO status, and a dramatic curtailment of the Ukrainian armed forces. Those appear to be Russia's objectives in negotiations. And now Putin is calling for a neutral government overseen by third-party armed forces. I'm not sure who he has in mind, but he's not talking about NATO. He might be talking about people from Brazil or India or China, North Korea. this is not exactly going to go down. It's not something that appears to be designed to go along with what Trump is proposing at all. But anyway, the whole idea of these Russian democratic gains, which is what they are actually, the ascent of Crimea and the four provinces to Russia, which were all voted through improper referenda, and the idea that referenda should take place in other places for instance in Odessa there was a terrible massacre on May the 2nd 2014. So we're talking about the 11th anniversary of that massacre is coming up on May the 2nd this year. Odessa is clearly an area that's been subjected to oppression on a massive scale by Ukrainian Nazis. And it's very clear that there should be a referendum there on the population, a proper referendum on the population having the right to actually choose where it belongs. And the same goes for the Kharkov area, and probably a few of the other areas adjoining Kiev, actually, right across the division of Ukraine from the Dnieper. In fact, that area is majority Russian speaking, the whole of it. And of course, the Ukrainian Maidan prophet has been to persecute. The policy has been to persecute Russian speakers for the whole of the last 16. That's the last 12 years, Anyway, these do have a democratic content, and because of that, they're anathema to the West European ruling classes. The position of the position of the Trump administration over Ukraine, it's only half a break from Biden's, to be honest. Instead of simply arming Ukraine, they now threaten to continue Biden's policy if Putin doesn't agree to something that they find acceptable. But that's not really very convincing, because they don't have the resources to continue that indefinitely. And that's at odds with Trump's strategy. And I think we know what Trump's strategy is, actually. He regards China, not Russia, as the Americans, the United States' strategic adversary, as it's on course to surpass the US in economic power in the immediate future. And much of its economic power derives from capitalism overlaid by economic planning, whose origin was in the Chinese Revolution, beyond capitalism, that is. You know, and unlike in Russia, planning in China has continuity and has never really been broken, you know, even temporarily. China certainly has a powerful billionaire bourgeois class, but it's, you know, planning has remained, you know, intact as an institution for the whole of the period. For the whole of the period when Russia was subjected to shock treatment, etc., in the 90s, that never actually happened in that way in China. So I think that is a difference, and it's the bourgeois class to a certain extent sees a difference, and Trump is basing his strategy in part on that difference. They want to split Russia and China if they can. You know, so we see this tactical softening of U.S. treatment of Russia from the Trump administration. That's not really true of China. Instead, we actually see open hatred from the Trump administration of what they call communist China. And I think that's a slight over-egging of the pudding in these days, although it's formally true. The Chinese Communist Party have been very, very, you know, sort of subservient to capital and tame, you know. But nevertheless, it's using that Cold War rhetoric against China. It also uses that kind of rhetoric against its opponents domestically, including the Democrats, who it incredibly refers to as being far-left Marxists, which is a joke, of course, you know. But again, as I said, much of Trump's seeming sympathy for Russia is driven by this aim of setting Russia against China. I think that's unlikely, though, because there is so much imperialist hostility to Russia that even though Trump has appeared to set it aside for tactical reasons, it's still very much there. You know, the Russian state is bound up with a very stunted kind of capitalism that's very deformed by many decades of post-capitalist development, which Russia's comparatively weak capitalists cannot conjure away. It's not that the Russian state is weak, but the oligarchs certainly are, and a number of them have ended up dead, of course, or in jail, and they complain bitterly about what Putin has done, punish them, you know. The Russians are aware of the enmity of the West and of Trump's motives. His threats of tariffs against BRICS, if they introduce a new currency as an alternative to a dollar, really have similar motives. But nevertheless, Trump's shift of tactics and his strategic shifts mean that the differences in NATO are severe. And we never witnessed such a falling out of Europe with the United States before. You know, the ruling classes of Western Europe are used to being Washington's clients since World War II. They're not used to being treated with such contempt. And what's behind this is that Washington has woken up to the fact that it's no longer hegemonic. It doesn't mean that it's lost all its power, but it's lost power in Ukraine. It's lost the war in Ukraine. And Trump's policy is a temporary retreat to reconsolidate U.S. rule in the Western Hemisphere in the short term with the aim of a later reconquest of hegemony. His theory about this change is rampant in the ruling classes in Britain, in France and Germany, and probably smaller powers like Holland, etc. as well, within the EU. You know, it's resulting in anti-democratic actions that overlap with the Cold War with Russia, but which also encompass bourgeois forces located in other former workers' states, such as Eastern Germany or Slovakia or Hungary or Serbia or Romania, which are either annexed components of the imperialist state of Germany, or they're ex-workers states and members of the EU, or clients and outside it, such as Serbia, you know. And there have been attempts, or there are ongoing attempts, actually, to organise Maidan-type colour revolutions in a number of these places. Even those who are in the EU, like Hungary and Slovakia, you know. We see that these movements are being brought into being, are being conjured into being in a way that looks very familiar from Ukraine, you know. There have been mass protests in Slovakia and Hungary, but then again, that goes hand in hand with the fact that an attempt was made last May to murder Robert Fischer, who is the left social democratic, well, he's sort of social democratic anyway, the Prime Minister of Slovakia, for his criticism of the Ukraine war, very, very clearly. And the government of Serbia is politically alike to Slovakia in some ways. It's also sort of social democratic in a way, based on the ex-Stalinist parties, of course, as is true in a lot of places. It's also been threatened with EU-incited colour revolution, which is really a coup with popular trimmings, you know. Now, we don't have any regard for the pro-Zionist, anti-migrant government of Viktor Orban in Hungary. And we probably have even less regard for the very right-wing popular presidential candidate in Romania, whose name is Calin Georgescu, who actually approves of General Antonescu, who was the wartime ruler of Romania and an ally of Hitler, you know. And I don't think we have any real sympathy for the Alternative für Deutschland, which is the sort of right-wing, implicitly right-wing, very right-wing, and implicitly Nazi political party that's a substantial opposition in Germany, main basis in former East Germany, you know. It's pretty right-wing, and it's hostile to the Ukraine war, you know. It does actually have a complement, though, a counterpart, in a sense, on the left in Germany, which is the ASW of Sarah Wagenknecht, which actually also opposes the Ukraine proxy war from more of a leftist standpoint, and appears to have been kept out of the Bundestag by some sort of electoral fiddle from the ruling fast parties, and I believe there's a court case going on about that, you know. All of those forces are hostile to the imperialist proxy war against Russia in Ukraine, and you know, irrespective of whether these forces are to the right or the left in formal terms, what's actually happening is that a degree of popular resistance to the NATO proxy war is being expressed through them. When they all express popular unease in what are former worker states being drawn into an imperialist war, which could well become a European or worldwide conflict, even nuclear perhaps, against Russia. So we should condemn all the attempted coups, the assassinations, and the other atrocities aimed at those populations, at dragooning them into a war with Russia. You know, I mean, these forces represent spontaneous populism, sometimes left-wing, sometimes right-wing, and sort of really grotesque, you know, unsavory policies, but they're not really to be equated with the Ukrainian Nazis, at least not at the moment, anyway, who are under NATO command, who are just simply continuing what their forebears did on the Eastern Front. Then under the command of Hitler and German imperialism, of course, but now under the command of the West European bourgeoisies and of the United States at times. You know. So, Starmer and Macron want to send troops to Ukraine as so-called peacekeepers. Macron is sort of elevating and, you know, sort of highlighting France's status as a power with a nuclear arsenal, the so-called force to frappe, or strike force, which is independent of American control and has been since de Gaulle created it, really. Which is not true of Britain, of course, because his Trident missile system is under the control of the United States, ultimately, you know. And France says it could put Western and Central Europe under its nuclear umbrella, against Russia. Germany, on the other hand, has said that it's got a new chancellor who's not actually taken office yet, but he's going to fairly soon, which is Friedrich Merz, and he has ruled out any German participation in such a force without Russian consent. But Trump has refused to back any West European or NATO armed intervention in Ukraine. And he's ruled out US assistance under NATO's Article 5 clause, which is its mutual assistance clause, that if anybody is attacked by an external force, the entirety of NATO will come to their aid. Without that, if that's not operative, NATO ceases to be an effective alliance at all. That is the situation. It's ceasing to be effective with the current configurations in the leadership of the United States. And the hysteria in the West European ruling classes over this has led to various military officers and usually retired ones, actually, and politicians to raise the idea of conscripting the population against Russia. But it's not Russia that's threatening to send its troops to threaten to attack Britain, France, or Germany. It's Britain and France who want to send troops to threaten Russia at its southwestern border. And now they're planning to send a small but symbolic Anglo-French what they call a reassurance force to Ukraine, partly to train Ukrainians, partly to act as an actual military presence of France and Germany in Ukraine, to escalate, and effectively it amounts to a declaration of war against Russia, particularly if Russia chooses to take it that way. Whether it will is another question, because Putin is very tactical on these things. But all this could actually mean an aggressive European war in Eastern Europe, waged by Britain and France, overseen by the European Union under the president of its commission, the European Commission, is a right-wing German politician, Ursula von der Leyen. And there's a pathetic wave of military jingoism coming from the British ruling class, which is really decrepit. And under Boris Johnson and the various successors he had for a short period, Truss and Sunak, and now under Starmer, Britain has been the most virulently militaristic over Ukraine. And this stuff leads straight to the idea of conscription, But the top brass of the British Army has let it be known through the Daily Telegraph that they consider the idea of that is ridiculous. But it's not, And we're seeing renewed austerity being driven by the Starmer regime's commitment to the crusade against Russia in Ukraine. They signed a partnership to aid Ukraine for 100 years. And to finance this, and billions of pounds worth of other promises to Ukraine in terms of military and other expenditure, he's cut foreign aid to numerous places. And now we see Rachel Reeves' attack on the disabled through cuts in personal independence payments and other cuts. It's also driven by military aid to Ukraine against its Russian-speaking population, as well as aid to Israel, I think. And these cuts are more brutal than George Osborne's Tory attacks of a decade ago. Looks like this is beginning to catalyse some revolt at the base of the Labour Party. It's potentially putting Starmer in political trouble. There have been a number of defections of councillors in the last few weeks. There have been some by-election victories against Labour in council elections that have put in left-wing independents against him, including one actually in Wes Streeting's constituency again, which he knew he lost in the general election. To Leanne Mohammed, I think it was, an independent candidate who came within a whisker of knocking out Wes Streeting. Well, somebody beat the Labour Party by a similar independent. He got 47% of the vote in a council by-election there a few days ago, as the Labour Party got about 23% or something like that. I can't remember exactly the figures. So, that just shows how politics is extremely fluid. And it's the reason, of course, why the ruling classes are targeting repression against the potential for political resistance cohering. So we're seeing that with the blatant attacks on Palestine protesters. I mean, it's happened in the US in a more extreme manner. You know, we see the Mahmoud Khalil case. I mean, this is connected directly with Zionism, more so much with the Ukraine issue. But where Zionism is concerned, the European and the West European and the United States are pretty much united, to be honest. Even under Trump, we see the grovelling of Starmer to Trump. The statement that he likes and respects Donald Trump was made a few days ago, wasn't it? You know, well, that's not what they used to say about him. You know, but as I said, the blatant attacks on Palestine protesters in the US, Mahmoud Khalil, a green card holder, being detained and threatened with deportation for protesting against genocide on Columbia University, it's outrageous. But it's also a sign of weakness and fear from the Zionists, as the attacks on the acts of repression in Britain. I mean, there's huge political anger over the Zionist genocide, and that's been true for the entire period of the slaughter, beginning in October 2023. And up to now, there's been a division of consciousness between a widespread understanding of what Zionism and what this war, what the war in Gaza is all about, and a lack of understanding and nervousness of many politicised people concerning the war in Ukraine. But the division in the ruling class, as the Trump-induced crisis in NATO has brought about, seems to have broken that sort of logjam a little bit. And that's reflected among some activists on the left. I mean, there's a whole layer of bureaucratic forces who were pro-Zelensky liberals, really, centering around John McDonnell, actually, who's, you know, the former shadow chancellor under Corbyn, and very, very appalling politically, in my view. I mean, that layer has become much more virulent, and even people who were, many of them were already known to be hysterically Russophobic and backers of NATO, but some of them actually preferred to be a bit sort of a cagey about that and not say anything about it. But they've suddenly become much more jingoistic as NATO came under threat of splitting and disintegrating. But they've also met much stronger opposition, you know. And there are many who were previously reticent in speaking out defending Russia, given the hysteria, who are now doing so, you know. And I've noticed that over the last several weeks since Trump's falling out with Zelensky, that there's been a lot more resonance and support for strong pro-Russian statements on social media and what, than there used to be, when people would shy away, you know. And that's good, I think. You know, that is a good social reality, you know. Defense of Russia in this war is a key principle position of communists, and that's coupled with militant support for the Palestinian struggle against genocide, against oppression, and for national liberation. Those are key elements of the communist program today, and we need a broader layer of the left to campaign for the working class to combat these wars and genocide, including through things like political strikes and other mass actions, if we can get them, you know. We certainly need to advocate them, and we've been defenders of Russia since the early days of Maidan. We've noticed a gradual shift leftwards among the more serious left on this question, and there are grounds for optimism, I think, that's deepening. And we seek the regroupment of subjectively revolutionary aspiring communists and revolutionary socialists in a new international communist movement, a new communist international. That's what we need. And I think there are grounds to be optimistic about that. So we need to conclude, we need an expanded communist movement, and we need a force that can intervene in electoral terms and give leadership in anti-war actions, in strikes and other past struggles, to give revolutionary leadership in the struggles to come. And I'll leave it there. I'll open up for discussion. I'm not going to share this meeting. It's Paul who's going to share it, yeah. So I hand over to Paul. Thank you, comrades.
Well done, Ian. May I remind comrades that this meeting is being recorded. So, if possible, please keep your contributions to one person at a time. Also, ideally, to avoid external sounds like coffee cups interfering with the sound recording, people should mute when they're not actually speaking, because there's a couple of comrades still unmuted and the sound is interfering with the recording. So who would like to start? And please indicate when you wish to speak. I can see you on the screen if you use your virtual hand, if you're not on camera, or you can use your physical hand if you are on camera, because I can see you. So who wants to start? Weevo?
Me?
Yep, go ahead.
All right, cool. Well, evidently, imperialism is in decline. It's like a repeat story of the Roman Empire all over again. And NATO splitting up, it seems like the Trump camp seems to want to focus on taking down China, whereas the EU camp seems to want to focus on taking down Russia first. Why Russia? Because the EU needs its natural resources, rare earth, oil and gas, etc., etc., whereas the U.S. has already its own sources elsewhere in the world. So this is kind of like a strange split. But, you know, how does European imperialism want to take on a militarily superior Russia? It's insane. It's like Napoleon and Hitler all over again. You know, I mean, they can't win militarily, and they can't even motivate their own populations in Holland and elsewhere to ideologically to mobilize them to start a war on Russia. I mean, there is no obvious reason for Russia to invade Holland, etc., etc., and they have a clear, justifiable motivation to destroy the Kerensky regime, because it's once again the phenomenon of fascism on the borders of Russian territory, right? Just like in the time of Hitler. So, but then again, the imperialists, they are aiming to split up Putin and Xi, Russia and China, as they did in the 50s when Mao sided with America, condemning Russia as being social imperialists, right? But that is most unlikely to happen today, because they are integrating quite rapidly, economically, etc., on all kinds of levels within the BRICS alliance. Sadly, we must notice that Russia, for example, invites Israel to the May 9th celebration or commemoration of the liberation of the Soviet Union, the defeat of fascism in Germany. So it's a very political and militarily weak alliance. The question is, to me, the ultimate struggle is not going to be between BRICS and U.S. imperialism, but between U.S. imperialism and the EU imperialists. It's going to be a new inter-imperialist military struggle if we can't prevent it from happening. It's not going to be between BRICS. I mean, for crying out loud, as Ian pointed out, the genocide just keeps going on and on and on and on and on in Gaza. And what does Russia do? What does China do? Do they at least withdraw their political, their diplomatic relations? No, not even that. Not even that. Because they realize that America still has, is still the number one military power. They still have the biggest economy in the world. And the US dollar is still the number one currency in the world. And they submit to that. Both Russia and China, you know, are still in that mindset of trying to maintain peaceful coexistence with imperialism. Yeah, that's my contribution.
Thank you both. Susan.
Sorry?
Susan.
You want to put my hand up?
Ah, we can hear you now.
Yes, that's all right. I'm unmuted. Okay. I do agree that the fight is between is imperialist, and I do agree that the fight certainly is between America and Europe over what sort of imperialism. But what I would say is Russia and China and Iran and even certain other countries' strategy is to buy time to prepare as much as possible, but they know that they are, you know, what is it they say? We'll either hang together, you know, we have got to hang together or we will hang separately. They do not intend to be knocked over one at a time. It's not that they think that Americans can win anymore, and as far as I can see, it is China whose economy is much bigger than America's, and it is Russia that still has the resources. But what we do have is neither Russia nor China particularly want a global economic or military meltdown, which means that they will keep buying as much time as they can and putting off the idiocy of a tactical nuclear war, which is what the morons in who are running the White House, shall we say, deep state, whether, you know, the Uniparty, because it doesn't matter who is in power, Republican or Democrat, they all think they can win a nuclear war in which they strike first. They are the only people who strike because nobody else wants a war, so therefore they will get away with it. Well, number one, they won't, because Russia has already said if they get struck, they will hit back. And the same with Iran and the same with China. They all have hypersonic weapons. They do not need to use nuclear weapons, but they can take out America's nuclear weapons if they need to with hypersonic. And I don't think that what we are looking at is necessarily America trying to go to war with everyone. I think what we are having is the globalists who are in control will impose an increasingly authoritarian fascist state on Europe and on Canada and on all the other proxies that they've got, and they are simply trying to concentrate as much wealth in as few hands as they can. And the BRICS countries are going to go ahead without us. They will continue to enrich their own populations and to bring them as much progress as they can. And they will, if they can do it without going to war with America and Europe, they will. But if not, they're going to contain it to as few countries as possible. You know, the brinkmanship at the moment with Iran, that they are threatening to bomb Iran because the war in Ukraine is being lost, is horrific. The idea that you would, you know, that Israel is going to accept it. I think the big problem for Russia, and I'm not pretending I understand, you know, your frustration as you see it from your end, is my understanding is that there are a great many rich and powerful Jewish Zionists in Russia who have an enormous amount of leverage. There are very few Zionists in China. So China can afford to be more aggressive in pushing back against America. Russia cannot afford it. It is going to have to be polite. And it does choose to be polite because Putin's you know, Putin is diplomatic, and we shouldn't confuse diplomacy with weakness. Yeah, you know, leaders can be diplomatic and polite without believing a word that, you know, perfidious Albion says, whichever side of the pond they are. So I think we have to wait and see. But BRICS is going ahead. Putin's latest speeches have said quite clearly, doesn't matter. We're not going to be taken off SWIFT. We're not going to lose any sanctions. Nothing is going to happen. We are going to go ahead and we will be independent, and there will be nothing that they can do. And if they bomb us, whether it's nuclear or anything else, we will push back. But we're going to wait and let it happen.
Just quickly.
Yep.
Thank you. Hold on, we both.
Okay.
Thank you. Ian wishes to speak. Go ahead, Ian.
Yeah, I think the point is sorry, am I unmuted? Can you hear me now, yeah? Yes, I think
we can, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Just on this question of Russia and Israel, I think that there's always been an implicit thing about the Russiagate scandal, supposedly, the fake Russiagate scandal, was actually always an indirect involvement of Zionism, because I don't think Russia is controlled by a Zionist lobby. I don't think anything remotely like that exists in Russia. But what I do think is they have a position of live and let live. I think both sides of that divide, they do not seek conflict with each other, because Israel knows that it would be smashed for smithereens if it got into a all that conflict with Russia. And Russia, it's just an additional potential problem if that did happen, you know. And they've got enough on their plate with Western Europe and the United States. I think that's their position. You have to remember that Russia is not even formally communist anymore. Unlike China, you can levy that criticism against China for its Stalinist peaceful coexistence, which is to the nth degree. You know that, possibly you could argue, it's been taken to the nth degree. It's a lot further than anything Stalin ever did. But in terms of Russia, I think that it's not even formally ideologically communist. You can't really fit in that framework. It's purely national pragmatic politics. It's the same as the attitude of some countries like, I don't know, just an example, Brazil or Argentina towards Russia. You know, I think they are affected to a lesser degree than the imperialist countries by the Zionist lobby, but they are wary of getting into an all-out conflict with Israel, as well as all the other conflicts in the world. And I think that's the real explanation for the Russiagate thing in Russia, in the United States, was actually that that Trump was very close to Israel, but he's not that keen on a conflict with Russia as well, you know. And that's part of it. It's part of the picture, I think, you know. That's actually debatable, I suppose. But I think that's implicitly what's involved in some of these complex sort of Byzantine, these relations anyway. You know, it was never true that Trump was an agent of Russia. That was absolute bullshit. You know. And that is what the Democrats are effectively saying. And that's what the hysterical European bourgeoisies are saying as well, under their breath, because they don't dare to openly confront the United States that Trump is solidly in power and has a popular mandate. But nevertheless, that's what they're saying, that Trump is a puppet of Putin. And that's complete bollocks, you know. And it's more complex. It's because of it's probably Israel does play a certain role in that, I think, you know. That's my suspicion anyway. You know, I've had that suspicion for a while. But basically, the Israelis don't want conflict with Russia, and there's an element of peaceful coexistence there, without the sort of peculiar influence of the Zionist lobby in the United States, which I think is a different question. I'll leave it there anyway. I think we know what's to speak.
I could see that Weebo was looking very animated. Go ahead, Weebo.
Well, it just seems to be such a blatant contradiction, you know. Zionism, as Ian pointed out, is continuing its genocidal, you know, practices on the ground, murdering. I mean, it's too horrific to even go into details, never mind. I just get sick of it to my stomach. And then, you know, Russia as post-USSR capitalistic society celebrating grandly every year. It's a grand national holiday. Everybody participates. The end of fascism in Germany, their defeat in Europe and in the USSR, and they end up, you know, inviting, which is evident to everybody in the world, any sane, any worker, any student with half a brain realizes that what is happening in Gaza is outright, you know, how do you say it? The revolution is not going to be recorded, but genocide is. It's evidently a placating by Russia of U.S. imperialism, because they know that the U.S. has 300 military bases around the globe. They still have the biggest economy. Yes, they do, ahead of China. It's still more productive than China. And they have the U.S. dollar as still the most dominant, or as the primary exchange currency in the world. And again, you know, in the past, the period 53-69, U.S. imperialism was able to break the USSR-China alliance by pulling Mao Zedong into supporting the U.S. war in Vietnam, right? So they're playing on, it's the same fucking game once again. But of course, it will have much less, you know, chance of success, because both parties, China and Russia, realize that U.S. imperialism is now in decline. It's an absolute decline. So, I don't know. I'm just saying that, you know, the whole BRICS alliance is pretty fragile. You know, it's being eroded by the Workers' League and other forces. But politically, economically, it's getting stronger. But politically, it's still very weak. And militarily, it doesn't mean anything. So what are we looking at an upcoming inter-imperialist war, or, you know, possibility of, between the EU and the US? Or is it more likely that the BRICS bloc is going to find itself in military conflict with the US? That's what I'm wondering about.
Thanks, Weebo. Before I bring Susan in, Weebo, you mentioned, I think the thing you were looking for, it was a song by Gil Scott-Heron called "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised." I think that was the one you were thinking of, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
I want to bring Susan in, and I want to bring Jonathan in, because I think he was disagreeing with some of what I said, so I would like to get Jonathan's take after Susan's spoken.
Well, my point was just that...
No, we both. Hold on. I'm going to bring Susan in first, and then I'm going to bring in Jonathan, and then I'll bring you back in. Go ahead, Susan.
The genocide is being...
We both, please.
Sorry.
Okay. Susan, you can unmute now, Susan.
Yeah, okay. I think, for me, what we are not recognising is the genocide is happening across the world. For me, the genocide is happening. It is happening in Syria. It happened in Libya. Happened in Afghanistan. It happened. It is happening in Yemen. People forget, you know, hundreds, isn't it? It's well over 100,000 people in Yemen have been killed in the last decade alone from American and British and Saudi bombing. We are not talking about things. I know that it's 200,000 people in Gaza, but because it's in such a tiny space and because there is nowhere to hide all of the bodies. Before now, there are tens of thousands of people being killed in the last 3 months alone in Syria. It is, you know, and it is constant across the world. As people say, black and brown people are being killed in their tens of thousands. And when they're not being bombed, they are being starved or they are being poisoned by lack of water and lack of energy and lack of facilities because of the sheer way in which the financial world piles debt on them and then deprives them of their resources. So we have both an American military machine, and we have to look bigger than Gaza, however horrific it is, and however much in our faces it is, and look at the bigger picture, which is the imperialist one. And for the left, the danger is we have looked at this and we have had, you know, the unremitting hate figure is communism, it's socialism, it is the idea that there is equality for all humanity. And imperialism doesn't allow that. It says there is a ruling class. There are people who deserve more. There is bigotry that says, you know, one Israeli life is worth 100,000 Arab lives, if that's what it takes to make them live in fear for their very existence. And we have got to stop, you know, that's what we've got to fight. And that is why we are being oppressed more and more. I'm looking at academia being told it can't talk, it can't debate, it mustn't be, you know, it's all anti-Semitism. But underneath it is all anti-socialist, it is anti-communist. And we are being threatened by, a ruling class that says we must have money. It's trying to create hysteria and fear so that it can have a European army. But the European army isn't going to be sent to fight Russia. It's going to be sent to oppress us so that we can't fight back against the fact we don't have our, you know, necessary means to live. You know, we don't have enough money for food, for welfare, for medical care, for education. And we are increasingly having, you know, our education system is being undermined in order to ensure that the message is, you know, Israel, Ukraine, you know, we are being told Ukraine is freedom and democracy and values when we know perfectly well it's not. It's a bunch of Banderites who are running a Nazi regime.
Right.
What's happening with Israel is a travesty of the Torah and I can feel desperately sorry for those Jews who, whether they're Reform or Orthodox, who are devastated by the misuse that is being done. But there are very few Christians who are even slightly aware of how much Zionism is misusing their religion as well. And certainly there are very few Catholics who seem to be aware of how the Vatican is misusing their power and their authority to encourage people to continue this imperialist drive and their witch hunt against orthodoxy in Orthodox Christians. We on the left are far too many people are secular and therefore just don't understand or have taken the trouble to find out about, you know, how important the difference is that Shia and Sunni have been set against each other. So we have to be really careful about the ends and the means, what's happening, as well as what we are being misused and targeted against. So I'm going to stop, but what I am saying is we have to concentrate on what are these globalists, what are these imperialists really trying to achieve, and how are they trying to fool us into thinking that, you know, that we are being attacked, that the dangers come from Russia or China or Iraq or Iran or, you know, terrorists generally, when in actual fact the terrorists are actually working together. Look at HTS supporting Israel. No? Islamists supporting Zionists. You've got Tommy Robinson and his bunch of yobs supporting Zionists. Yes, they know what the agenda is. It's wipe out anybody who is tolerant or socialist or who cares about humanity. Yeah?
Thanks, Susan. I'm going to do a roll call because there's a few people that wish to speak. So I'm going to start with Jonathan, if I That's may, awesome. Because I've seen by his body language there's an indication that he'd like to speak. Then I'm going to go to Diana, because she's got her hand up. And then I'm going to go back to Weibo, because I could see that he clearly wants to come back. So I'm going to start with Jonathan. Afternoon, Jonathan. Go ahead.
All right. Good afternoon. No, I was just thinking that about all this. Right, it's very difficult to comment on the period you're living in, you know. It's not that easy sometimes. Sometimes it is a bit easier than others. But I think this is a very difficult period to comment on what exactly is happening. And what I haven't heard is, you know, like in history, there's a subjective element to all this, right? You know, the character of the Second World War, right, the way Britain faced up to it was heavily dependent on the subjective character of Churchill. I mean, he played a very, and the same with Stalin in Russia. Those roles could have been very different with a different leader. And so it's very difficult to predict what the actions of the various elites are going to do around the world, because there's a subjective element to it all, and it's very difficult to predict how they take the situation to be and how they act. And it's only in hindsight we can see that Stalin and Churchill influenced the war in a certain way, and it could have taken a very different path had there been other leaders. But that's how it goes. And I'm not really sure why, I mean, I don't know if there's an element of subjectivity here, why Yemen is steadfast in supporting, you know, in supporting the Palestinians. I mean, I don't know their relationship, and I certainly don't know the relationship of Zionism to Russia and these are all questions, and it's very difficult to answer some of them. Anyway, I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Jonathan. Afternoon, Diana. Go ahead.
Yeah, so got a question really about how do you measure an economy size and what the implications of sizes of economies are. I take it that the order of sizes of economy are listed according to the size of GDP, gross domestic product. But that begs the question of how that is measured. So presumably the US has a greater GDP than China, but what does that GDP consist of? It can be a load of stuff. It can be manufacturing. It can measure what lawyers do, what bureaucrats do, a whole load of stuff. And even if it's measuring manufacturing, how effective is that in the US compared within China? Because what's been happening, why the US is not winning the war against Russia is because it can't produce weapons at the same uh, as as efficiently, as effectively, and at the same rate as Russia. And that's because Russia still has some elements of the communist system, so that the state is has a big role to play in, a major role to play in its manufacturing, whereas in the US everything is privatized, it's all driven by profit, and everything is made for maximum profit, not usefulness. Another point is that I'm not sure what's happening in mainland Europe, but certainly in Britain and the US, public funding for education is being slashed, being privatized. So, you know, I got free higher education because of my age, but people don't get that now. So if you've got poor education, you're not turning out people, you're not turning out engineers, people with technical ability and knowledge, people with scientific knowledge, and that has a knock-on effect on the development and manufacturing ability. Whereas China is investing in its education, you get free education in China, and I suspect the same is true in Russia, although I know a bit less about that. So although the US might look like it's got a bigger economy in terms of GDP, effectively, has it really got a more effective economy than China, or even than Russia, if it comes to that? That's a question.
Okay, before I bring Weibo back in, we'd just like to make one observation. Danny, you mentioned about the privatisation of the American school system. Obviously, in the UK, we have what's called academies, which are state-funded schools, but effectively operate like private schools. In America, they call the same type of school charter schools. So if you ever see the term charter schools, that's what they are. They're basically, they're equivalent of our academies. So that's one aspect. I'm going to bring Weibo back in, but as Weibo is speaking, can Comrade bear in mind about Diana's question about GDP and indicate whether they wish to answer that? I think Ian might well answer that, but I'll bring Weibo back in by all means, because I did say that he'll speak next, and I can see Ian put his hand up now, so Weibo and then Ian.
Okay, thanks a lot. Yeah, just to thanks again to pointing out that there's not only genocide happening in Gaza, but also in Yemen. Not only in Yemen, but also on our national situations, where the elderly, the chronically ill, are to be discarded by the bourgeois state. And we may speak in the West of the democratic, the twin of fascism, which is democratic imperialism, right? And I'm sorry, but again, the whole COVID period, when vaccines were being obligated to get to work, which cost no more than a 3% victimization of the populations, the usual elderly, the usual chronically ill, etc., is just an indication of the bourgeois state not being interested in maintaining the financing of chronically ill and elderly populations. It's just not financially profitable. Yeah, and also, of course, you know, I mean, genocide is nothing strange to democratic imperialism. Every year, unnecessarily, due to preventable diseases, hundreds of thousands of children die in the third world. But they don't have the kind of purchasing power that is interesting for Western multinational companies. So it's obvious disregard by actually the dictatorship of finance capital, which disguises itself as being democratic and some kind of alternative to fascist practices, while in fact there is no qualitative difference. The COVID vaccine pandemic required normally, you know, for the development of new vaccines, required 10 to 15 year protocol research, etc. And they came with new vaccines within 2 years. It's too insane for words. All based on the scientific research done by a Fauci, who was a paid servant via the World Health Organization, financed by the U.S., throwing out, bullshit science. Anyways, so... And I'd just like to propose, I've been going on for a while, that we kind of try to limit our contributions to 4 or 5 minutes and then move on to the next person.
Ian, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, just 3 points. One is in regard to Diana's points about GDP. I think she's probably right. I think the quality of GDP, China is, I reckon, colloquially referred to these days as the workshop of the world, and the bulk of its GDP and industrial output is classically manufacturing productive. That is not true of the United States increasingly. It's not true of Britain. And Britain is supposed to be the fifth or sixth biggest economy in the world. But that's somewhat misleading because a lot of it is service industries, which don't really produce anything that are, that they are not tangible material wealth in quite the same way. You know, they are manipulating existing resources and not actually producing new ones. I suppose that's one way of looking at it, you know. So I think there's a very large extent that's true of the United States. And there are things that are counted as GDP, which probably are not really strictly a product, you know, in the classic sense. I don't know. I mean, this is something that's worth considering anyway. But I don't have enough detailed knowledge to go into detail on that. The second point is about inter-imperialist war, which I'm a bit sceptical of that at the moment. I think the European bourgeoisies are outraged at being what they see as being betrayed by Trump, and they're not being prepared to go on with the proxy war, which they were just as fervent supporters of as Joe Biden was. Whether that would lead to an inter-imperialist conflict, I think is a bit doubtful, because I think the relationship of forces still regarding the United States and versus France, Britain, and even Germany is not good. I don't think they're in a position to be in some sort of really major conflict with the US. I just don't see it. I think the US is still too big and too distant as well. Remember, there is an ocean in the way. I just don't quite see it, really. I think it seems like a bit of a funny idea. But you never know. I mean, it could turn out that way eventually, but I don't think it's going to do it at the moment. But as we said before, there are other possibilities. There could be the emergence of new imperialisms in a multipolar world if the traditional imperialist hegemony were broken, you know. So I think there could be wars between BRICS or parts of BRICS on an expanded scale with the US or with Britain and France or whatever, or both. You know, that's a possibility. But I don't see an inter-imperialist war immediately on the horizon, though. I just don't see it. Regarding COVID and genocide, well, I don't necessarily agree with the way you're putting it, Weibo, but I do think that there were attempts to use COVID to cull the elderly. And they used the disease itself. They did it in British care homes. There was a huge scandal of the deliberate discharge of infected COVID patients from hospitals ordered by Matt Hancock, which caused a huge carnage in care homes of old people. That was deliberate. They even boasted about it in the Daily Telegraph. And there was some bastard, I can't remember his name, we quoted him as saying it would be great if we could get rid of a lot of these pensioners and it would save all. You know, and that's exactly what they did. It wasn't the vaccine that did it. It was the manipulation of the disease itself. And that's why I think you're wrong about quarantine, etc. They didn't implement quarantine. They did the opposite in certain cases. And I was saying that one of the criticisms of Boris Johnson's administration in particular, it was a more hypocritical version of Trump. Trump openly laughed about these things and suggested people should inject bloody disinfectant into their veins to combat COVID. Whereas what Johnson did is he ran mock lockdowns, lockdowns where the airports were not locked down, and so you couldn't really have a proper lockdown. And it was a contradiction in terms. And that's why, I mean, the rage about it is amazing, you know. There are people who'd like to tear Boris Johnson limb from limb, not because of his lockdown, but because of his non-lockdowns, because of his mockdowns, as they called it, you know. I think you've got that wrong. But, I mean, we could discuss, this is not really the subject of the discussion here, but we could have a discussion on it another time. But I do think that there is a lot of truth that they did, that COVID was used as a means of killing the elderly and the disabled. That is true, but not quite in the way you say it. Anyway, I'll leave it there for now. I know there are a few other people that want to speak up. I'll let Paul handle all that. Cheers.
If I may make a contribution of my own, following Diana and Ian's points about GDP. Mainly Ian pointing out to about the servant industry and the way it kind of allows balance sheet to show some form of growth where there isn't really any because they're not actually producing a product, as Ian mentions. Maybe that you could argue, or one could argue perhaps, that this is a demonstration of Karl Marx's rate of profit to fall. Because on the one hand, it looks like there's a growth, but Marxists understand that overall, the rate of profit has actually fallen over the generations. Not that the profit has fallen, but the rate at which the profit is made falls in the long term. That's what my understanding of what the rate of profit means. I'm going to take Mari first, afternoon, and then I'm going to bring Susan back. Thanks. Mari, go ahead. You've got the floor.
Hello. Yes, very good discussion. It is reasonable. I agree with everything that has been said. It's reasonable to wonder, like the comrades, like you have done, why is it that Russia?
It's been recorded.
What's happening? Can you hear me?
Somebody's unmuted. Comrades, when you're not speaking, please can you possibly mute your mic? Because it interferes with the recording. I noticed we've got two Weebos on here for some reason, and maybe that's causing a bit of interference. Sorry, Maui, continue.
So I was saying, it is quite reasonable that comrades are wondering why Russia and China have not achieved more between themselves. And I agree with, that there is still the legacy of the policy of peaceful coexistence going, which comes from the past. It comes from Stalinism and the communist movement. The communist movement has not overcome it. In fact, it doesn't discuss it. This is one of the questions I think we should go back upon, is that what happened to them after 1924 is not discussed in the world communist movement, and they are all falling out with each other about it. But nevertheless, apart from that, there is nevertheless an objective process which is bringing these big revolutionary countries together, and this is probably why imperialism is in such a panic, because they can see that, like one of you said, they can see that capitalism doesn't have the way to convince, the convincing arguments, the solid scientific explanation to explain to people why one has to be in capitalism. Capitalism doesn't have that. It cannot explain and it cannot convince. And so they realize and know that there is now people who understand much better than they do, and that already there is in practice all sorts of countries that follow Russia and China, like you were talking about the BRICS and so on. And even though the BRICS is a very uneven organization, it's also representing the division between those who command in the world and the immense majority of the population on the other side. I think I would like to come back a little bit on why is it then that Russia and China are not, why is it like I think Weibo was saying, why is it that we still have got the dollar as after all that time when there's been so many opportunities to create a new currency? Well, there is obviously a big problem here. It requires a certain level of cohesion between the BRICS, for example, and it requires also a certain consciousness of how the system works. And in fact, there is not a proper analysis from anywhere coming on a world scale, neither from Russia or China. They each defend their own form of society, but they do not explain how the system works and how to actually create that new currency. I think the opposition to it is so enormous as well, because there is still a certain capacity from world capitalism to put every obstacle in the way. So that would explain in part the slowness, the relative slowness of the process. But I think perhaps the most important aspect has been the abandonment of Marxism, which was, in fact, the norm. The Second International, when Engels lived, he had massive meetings of women, international women meetings, where they discussed Marxism. That got lost with the Third International after Lenin, and then the Third International was disbanded, and then with the disbandment of the Third International, there was a break from Marxism, which means that we are all now advancing empirically without a world head. We don't have a head, a thinking head on a world scale. So what I wanted to say, just to conclude, the type of genocide that took place in Donbass, I had more difficulty to explain it to myself than that of Gaza, for example, because in Gaza, you know, it's pretty obvious. But I think comrades insist that it was a genocidal policy in the Donbass and in Crimea. And I would like to return to that in the sense that it was not the quantity, perhaps, so much the masses of dead bodies, even though there was plenty of that. It was a qualitative kind of suppression, which was not just, you know, I don't like you, I'm killing you. It was that sort of killing which wants to kill you before you are dead, like the negation of your language, the negation of your where you were, of your own self as a creature, the negation of your humanity, which was behind every act which was carried out by these people in those days, and that was applied against the Romas and all sorts of that was very little talked about. All sorts of people were rounded up and they were tied up round trees and left to die. You know, none of that was reported in the press, which means that it's difficult now to associate. But I think it is as deep a devastation of humanity, of the dignity of humanity. It is a devastation as deep as what they are doing in Gaza or Yemen or Syria. And then finally, just about the policy of immigration, which has been adopted now in all the capitalist countries and in Britain. They are doing the same to the migrants. The migrant is treated like an animal or even worse. And there is behind the treatment of the migrant, there is something Nazi. You know, like in the beginning, they used to let people die in the sea. Then when that made a scandal, it was scandalous. So they pretended to bring back people to shore. But all of that is very, very, very false. A lot of that hides complete disregard for people and the want to kill. I think that perhaps one of the reasons why the process is so slow, seems to be slow, is because the transformation which is required is not just anti-capitalist, it's anti-Nazi. And that is not a new dimension, but it's a more deep, more profound, more sweeping change that is required. And, you know, to have that transformed, we need a communist, like Susan was mentioning, we need to oppose this anti-socialist, anti-communist rage and prejudice, complete prejudice. So we need to make communist proposals, you know, being tactical about it. But there's something that one can say, like mass meetings. Why is it that we never have a mass meeting in the streets? That were these street corners, you know, street meetings, in going to the factories where they are making the weapons and actually having mass demonstrations outside the factories, not just a few volunteers who stick their neck out and will be in prison next week. And that sort of thing, equipping the working class, turning towards the working class, talking about workers' committees, working class committees in the factories, working class anti-military working class committees in all the places where they make weapons. That sort of thing, if we take the time and the trouble, we can make leaflets and the consistent Democrats can make all sorts of articles towards this. So we are not claiming, you know, we are just the Red Revolution, but we are putting forward a program which is transitioning towards it, you know, and appeals to the army, for example, appeals to the soldiers. Yeah, that's it. I finished.
Thanks, Mary. Before I bring Susan in, I'd like to ask Ian, what time would you like to do any other business? You muted, Ian.
I was going to raise that question here because I think we should wind this discussion up fairly soon because it's getting close to 6 o'clock and we should have any other business. I mean, I've got to go in the not too distant future and I've got another job to do tonight. Apart from handling the recording of this, that is. So, yeah, I think we should do it fairly soon, like in the next. Let Susan speak and then conclude and go on to any other business. We can always continue to discuss another time. I mean, but we can't go on indefinitely, so I think we should do that, if that's all right.
Yes, okay, so I take Susan then, and then we'll go on to any other business, in which case I think we can stop the recording, can we not, after that bit. Susan, go ahead.
Stop when Susan's finished, yeah.
Two things I would like to point out. One is, as far as I understand it, Russia's losses after World War II, never mind the ones that they also lost in World War I, which was millions, is reckoned to be somewhere between 25 and 27, maybe even as high as 30 million people. China's, on the other hand, is reckoned to be well over 37 million people. So the idea that somehow, while America came off relatively unscathed from World War II, having made masses of money making weapons for World War I and World War II, you can't really compare the fact that, you know, Russia and China have taken a certain amount of time to recover. It took 15 years for the Bretton Woods to develop into the SWIFT system and the financial systems that allowed America to control it, and it took from 72 until 90 for America's control of the changing out of the gold standard and into the petrodollar. So the fact that BRICS has been built up in the last 25 years as a response to what I would say is America's completely grotesque exploitation of sanctions as a means of destroying countries economically when they weren't bombing them to hell, and their misuse of terrorists, because they are a terrorist state, even more so than either Ukraine with their kill lists and their horrific mistreatment of people of ethnic minorities in their own country, and Israel in terms of their treatment of the Palestinians the parts of the country they occupy. These are things that the West does not acknowledge or even has ever had to face. So there's that. Number two is Britain's involvement in both, supporting America blindly is in much down to the fact that our GDP is entirely fake. It's entirely based on the fact that we control the London Metal Exchange, which sets all the prices of metals and is massively powerful, therefore, in the economic world, but also our control of financial insurance. And it's been increasingly obvious that since the 1990s, the hedge funds, of which we have massive control of the pension funds, make most of their profits on leveraging the fact that they probably only put 1 or 2% of their own funds into the ventures that they have, the investments that they make. They then go round to other pension funds and persuade them that they will get massive amounts of money. And it's one vast Ponzi scheme. It is coming down because the Western Empire, led by the US, but also all of the countries of Europe and the UK, are totally dependent upon this financial Ponzi scheme that is backed up by an increasingly irrelevant military machine. The military-industrial complex is massively awash with money while it produces weapons that are increasingly expensive, but fortunately for us, are not as effective as they should be. They're very good at killing civilians, and we're now up to a point where probably 50% of the people they kill are civilians.
Yeah.
But they are not very good when it comes up against a peer army, which is, of course, what Russia has exposed in the last 3 years. And, you know, I sat down to dinner the other night at a conference, and they said, but, you know, Russia can't even fight Ukraine. And I said, no, Russia is fighting the whole of NATO. What you do not understand is that Ukraine has lost. I think it is now on its fourth army. You know, it had the second biggest army in Europe after Turkey, and now it has, it's on its fourth iteration of that. And, you know, the fact that UK and France are saying, yes, let's send 10,000 troops each, they are sitting there talking about them being ensconced safe away from the battlefield. And Putin has quite rightly said, come to, you know, if you fight in the war in Ukraine, you will be a target. Yeah. So the GDP is a fake. When you look at if you ask the government what's the average salary in this country, they put it at about 34,000 a year. But if I tell you that 43% of employed people in this country do not pay income tax, that means they earn less than 12,500 a year. Those two statistics cannot possibly be true. So why is it? Because the average wage is calculated on 35 hours a week at the minimum wage, and it is counted to include all the benefits you get from paying your council tax. They put in money that is a notional amount of all the protection you get from the police force that sit at home and answer calls only on a telephone. They make up things that you have as a benefit that are not part of your wages. You do not see them in your wallet. You cannot spend them. But so this, and that is exactly the same in America, where, you know, where a third of the country's employed people are living on food stamps. Mm. Yeah, we on, you know, China has raised 900,000 people out of poverty in the last 30 years. What's America done? What have we done? We've put nearly 10 million people into poverty. It's, you know, we are living in a fraud, a Ponzi scheme that we are continually told is perfect because we have freedom and democracy while they are busy saying, can't have Georgescu. They've got a second candidate they've removed. I don't care about the fact that these people are right wing because I don't believe any of it anymore. I don't know how right wing a right wing person is. Do I dislike Farage? Absolutely. Do I dislike Tommy Robinson? Absolutely. But we are not going to be any better. You know, we have to watch out for the fact that these people are being groomed to be the next acceptable faces. But there was, you know, but they got rid of Jeremy Corbyn and they'll get rid of anybody else. You know, we have a horrible blacklisting and vetting system. You know, the Zionists are, and certain other right-wing groups are taking over from where the blacklists were doing in the 1910s and 20s and 30s. And I hate to say it, Jonathan, but I would say we are forgetting that how the rise of the fascists in the 1930s, it wasn't just the Daily Heil that was supporting Hitler. You know, it was our dearly unloved Edward VIII who was busy supporting the fascists at the time. It wasn't just Mosley, but they, you know, Edward VIII was being lauded by Hitler. There is no mention anymore of the fact that Hitler offered Edward VIII and Wallace Simpson to be reinstated as king and queen if they had won. And Churchill was offered an agreement with Stalin, by Stalin, before he had to make the Ribbentrop Pact. They had to buy a year to prepare for the war. We forget it. You know, but the Americans don't. They say, Stalin would have had an agreement with Hitler, whereas Churchill had the shock of he'd kept Stalin at arm's length because he wanted a pact with America. And he thought that if he made a pact with Stalin against Hitler, that the Americans wouldn't come in on his side because they were, because they were anti-communist. In the end, the Americans just decided that Nazism was too dangerous, especially once they started to develop, their own version of the atom bomb, which would have put American lives at risk. And they've always fought their wars by proxy. So I think it's much more complicated than we think. But we are looking back. It's not just that we're confused by what's happening now. It's that we don't know anymore what was really happening then. They used to say, 2020 hindsight. But in actual fact, we forget the bits of the past that no longer make a narrative that we're comfortable with. Yeah. And that's what's more conflict. I don't understand why we are, I go to a meeting. I don't go to Labour Party meetings, but I go to trade union and trades council meetings where you will have the Labour people who will say, oh, but you've got to stick with us no matter how many bad things we do, because reform will be so much worse. And I'm going, how much worse can you get than what you're doing now? No, how are we going to fight all of this? Yeah. Anyway, I've talked too much and I meant to be quicker, but I hope I've explained why I think that why the GDP means nothing, but also this is why Trump is talking tariffs, trying to threaten things. He's trying to pinch economies, and what is happening is he is destroying both America's economy and Europe's. I don't think we've got an economy worth talking about. We're just living on borrowed time at the moment. No?
Okay, thanks, Susan, on that note of optimism.
You are so kind.
I think we need to wind this session up now. I would just like to make a couple of final remarks to say thank Conway for coming. I think it's been a very insightful and very successful meeting. We normally have these Sunday meetings every 2 weeks, which I think will make it April the 13th. But if not, those on the mailing list will get an update in the meantime. I know Ian got his hand up. Do you want to speak before you turn off the recording? Or?
Well, just briefly, I was going to say that I think we should do the Trotsky thing in 2 weeks' time, yeah? Carry on.
That sounds like a good idea to me. I think we've nearly finished it now, haven't we?
We're not far off, yeah.
Okay, are you going to send out a mail for that about a week beforehand, and then and so I will finish up by saying thank you for coming, and now we go on to any other business, if that's all right.
I'll switch the recording off.